Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to talk now about the Indiana Authors Awards that are an annual event, and I would like to remind our listeners that this is a recorded program, so we are not taking calls, emails, or questions or messages via social media, but we do hope you enjoy the conversation. My guests are Katie Withers. She is with the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation, and Phil Gulley, a well-known author and a familiar presence here at WFYI. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
So, Katie, I'm going to start with you. We've done this show, and I probably should say, in the interest of full disclosure, that I was one of the judges for the Indiana Authors Awards in years past. In fact, I voted for Phil a few times. So, talk to me a little bit about what the Indiana Authors Awards are.
Yeah, so the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award is now in its eighth year, and its goal is to promote a love of reading and writing across the state through celebrating all the great diverse literary talent that we have right here in Indiana, such as Phil Gulley and our other winners and finalists that we've had over the years. So that's its goal. It lasts all year long. In February, we have a public nomination period where people can nominate their favorite local authors. As you know from being on the award panel works for several months from March through June to go through all those nominations. Yes, it's quite the process, and they make their decisions in June. And then October 29th this year, we have an event during the day, the Indie Author Fair, where anyone can come from the public to do workshops about publishing, marketing, writing, as well as meet several of the authors, this year's winners and finalists, and many other local authors. And then that evening, there's an award dinner where we present the awards, have a silent auction, and raise some money for libraries.
And this year, the winners and finalists are?
Yes. So our national winner is Karen Joy Fowler. Our regional winner is Phil Gulley. We have three emerging author finalists, Sarah Gerkensmeyer, Bill Kinley, and Edward Kelsey Moore. And the winner in that category will be announced at the award dinner. And then this year we introduced a new category, which is genre excellence. It's going to rotate each year. So there will be a different genre where we pick an author in that genre to kind of highlight the diversity of writing in the state. This year's genre is children's picture books, and the winner is April Pulley Sayre.
Okay. And there is the events for much of the day on the 29th, which is 9 days from now, are free. But the dinner, there is a cost to attend. Do you still have spaces available for that, or is it a sellout?
We are sold out.
You are sold out. Well, that's good news. That's got to gratify people. So, Phil, how does it feel to be a winner?
Oh, it was a very nice surprise. Very nice surprise.
Had you been aware that you'd been nominated before? Is the fact that, you know, folks like me had been voting for you a shock to you?
I was. I had been nominated, I think, 4 or 5 years ago, but I couldn't make it. I'd had another commitment the day of the award down in Atlanta, and so was unable to be up here.
So what does receiving this kind of recognition mean to you as a writer?
Well, it's always a surprise to me whenever I get anything like this, or when, quite frankly, when anybody even buys my books. I'm always surprised that people want to read what I have to say, and it's gratifying, but always surprising.
So, I'm always fascinated. We do quite a few shows here where we talk with writers. I'm always fascinated with how the process starts for you. I mean, you know, were you one of those folks who always knew, even as a small boy, that you wanted to write? Or, you know, how did you come about it at the beginning?
Oh, I hated writing when I was a kid, and made a D in English composition at Marion University, and had the opportunity after graduating from seminary at Christian Theological Seminary to go over to Earlham School of Religion and take some writing classes from a man named Tom Mullen, and I just did it to help my sermon writing, and found that writing essays and sermons were just so enjoyable, and took it from there to thinking, well, if I can do that, I can maybe write a book. And so jumped in and started doing that.
So what was it, I know, and I'm asking you to step back into an earlier self here, that often is not an easy process. What was it about writing when you were younger, really up through, you know, your college years, that you didn't enjoy? What was the thing that that created the antipathy?
You know, I think the rules of grammar were a drawback. My teachers were very diligent that I follow that, and I didn't really want to. I wanted to write like I spoke, and we don't speak always
grammatically.
Grammatically. And I think it's because I was being told what to write. And just as soon as I could write what I was passionate about, it changed for me. And it went from being a forced march to kind of a dance.
Okay, so how did that occur? I mean, what you were at Earlham, and you were studying, actually, it sounds like under the father of one of my former newspaper colleagues, Ruth Mullen.
Sure,
Tom was her father. What was it that he did that sort of cut the knot there and allowed you to see it more as a means of expression rather than, you know, a form of torture?
I remember that moment exactly. It was the first essay I wrote for the class, which later became the first essay in my first book. And I handed it to him, and I said, forgive the sentence fragments. And he said, who cares about sentence fragments? And I just felt these shackles break. And it was wonderful. I thought, oh, I can just write and not have to be handcuffed? This is wonderful. And then it just took off.
How did you make the leap then from being reluctant writer to, you know, now a very prolific author? You know, that's a leap. Even for people who want to write, the idea of doing a book can seem intimidating. Or I know of a lot of gifted writers who are just terrified of showing their stuff, you know, their work to anyone else. That there's a tremendous amount of insecurity that comes with it. Mm-hmm. So how did you make that transition?
You know, I think for the writer, if you're going to do it, you can't be in angst about how your work will be received. E.B. White was asked once who he had in mind when he wrote for, and he always said he wrote for an audience of one himself. So if I'm writing something and I enjoy the process of writing it, I'm pretty certain that other folks will probably enjoy reading it. So that's kind of my standard, that if after a good day of writing, after a day of writing, if I look back and have felt good about that effort and have had moments of insight and fun with it, then probably others will too.
When do you know that it's good?
Generally the next morning. I let things season, you know. It's like soup and lasagna being better on the second day. If I still like it the next day, then that's an indication to me that it will probably make it into the book, that it will probably make the final cut. And if it hasn't survived the night, then I dispense with it.
Now, do you operate with, like, I think, you know, Hemingway's method, for example, was that he would write only in the morning, and he would write and always try to quit at a point when it was going well, so it would be easy to pick up. Other writers I've known set themselves like a word quota each day. What's your method of moving things along?
I write until I have worked myself into a wretched little corner and don't know where to proceed. And then I walk away from it, and by the next day I've figured my way out.
So it's like an exercise in problem solving.
Yes, and for, it really is.
So what? I mean, give me an example of like a wretched little corner that you would write yourself into, and then how you wrote yourself back out of it.
Well, I'm working on a book now called Unlearning God, and about all the stuff that we get taught about God as children, and that we unlearn as we age, and so you work yourself into either theological corners. Or you become very dismissive of the beliefs of other people, but you've had so much fun doing it that in the process it's fun because you can be sarcastic and cynical, and which is always fun to be when you write. But then after you sleep on it, you realize, well, that's more than sarcastic. That's rather unkind. And so the next day you find a way to temper that a bit.
You say you're working on a book on unlearning God, and a lot of your work has, and I'm not saying this disparagingly, some element almost of therapy or self-discovery to it. What starts, where does the idea for each book or each piece of writing start for you?
It's generally arises out of my experience as a Quaker pastor and just being with people. I've been doing that 32 years now. And the neat thing about being a pastor is that it brings you into people's lives in a significant way, and often in a way that is much deeper than the casual relationships that we tend to have with one another. So it becomes the genesis, then the seedbed for thinking about things that matter. Which tend to be, to me, kind of interior things.
We're coming up on a break, and this is maybe a larger question than we can deal with, and if so, we'll pick it up on the other side. Do you worry, because as you say, it's an intimate relationship, being a pastor, are there safeguards so that you don't feel like you're violating that relationship when you write about some of these things that you have in your own mind?
Certainly, you always have to change the names, you learn pretty quickly to talk about things that won't be hurtful to those who spoke with you. And you also learn that some things are simply off-limit, that no matter how well you might hide someone, those close to the situation will know and recognize the people involved. And so you learn that some stories just can't be written yet.
If you are just joining us, we are doing a special recorded No Limits in which we are talking with Katie Withers. She is development officer for the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation and author Philip Gully. The occasion for our conversation is the Indiana Author Awards. The dinner and the celebration of those awards is October 29th. Which is a little more than a week away. We hope you are enjoying the conversation. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking now about the Indiana Authors Awards. My guests are Katie Withers. She is with the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. She's a development officer. And one of the award winners, the regional award winner, author Philip Gully. This is a recorded conversation, so we are not able to take calls, emails, or questions via social media, but we do hope you're enjoying the conversation. Katie, we've been talking a lot about Phil's work, and obviously we understand some of where it comes from. What are the qualities that the judges and the Library Foundation looks for and wants to honor when it comes to bestowing these distinctions upon Indiana writers?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't know that there's a set answer for it. We really leave it to the panel, of which there's 9 members currently, but it ranges between 8 and 12 all across the state. They are literary experts in different ways to really make that determination. We have different categories. National is an author who is either from Indiana or has lived in Indiana for at least 5 years that is known on a national scale. Regional, which is the award Phil won this year, is also an author from Indiana or has lived in Indiana for 5 years who would be known throughout the state, which Phil definitely is in talking to people who love his work. Emerging, those finalists have to have written only one or two books, so they're not quite breaking out to where they have this real repertoire yet, but the one or two books they have are outstanding, and we really see promise in their work. With our new category, Genre Excellence, we had to be really specific this year about what we were looking for, and it's going to be different every year based on the genre. We consulted different children's librarians and children's book experts in creating very specific criteria for this year's Children's Picture Book Award. So that was fun, and we're looking forward to doing that again for the next genre, which we'll announce at the award dinner.
So is and are there a set of genres that that you're going to do in rotation? Do you know, like, there are four or five of them, or is it something that's much more fluid than that?
It's pretty fluid. We do have some ideas, and the whole point of the Genre Excellence category, the original intent with the Glick family in creating this was to honor genres that would appeal to families. That's why we started with children's picture books. So in future years, that might be something like graphic novels or middle grade fiction or science fiction, something that, would appeal to maybe reluctant readers a little bit more. But we're going to announce it on a year-by-year basis.
And we probably ought to emphasize that prize winners such as Phil get, you know, something more than just a warm feeling.
Yes, they do. Thanks to the generosity of the Glick Fund, they get a cash prize. And they also, and this is something I think is especially cool about the award, is they get to pick a public library in Indiana to receive a $2,500 grant. So that's something really special. And we've given over $55,000 through those grants in the 8 years of the award.
And have you decided which library, Phil, that your money is going to go to?
The Paoli Public Library.
Why there?
My wife grew up 10 miles south of Paoli.
Okay.
And the township she lived in, Greenfield Township, did not pay library taxes. And so as a child, she had no access to a public library. So this library grant will go to the Paoli Public Library to pay scholarships for the children in those townships that will permit them to have library access.
Why is that part so important? Because I know, again, and I probably ought to do the disclosure that I have been one of the judges, so I've been privy to some of these conversations, and I'm kind of teeing you up here, Katie, so that you can talk about the reason that this is structured so that libraries get that form of support.
Yeah, what we've seen in talking with all these authors is how important their library experience was growing up and creating the writers that they are today. And we want that for families now. We want kids and adults even to be able to come to the library and take that next step on their writing journey or their reading journey if they don't feel like they'll ever be a writer. But I would argue that all readers could be writers. That's something we want to promote through the award. So that's why we do it. And as Phil was kind of saying with the Paoli Public Library, there's a lot of needs throughout the state with these smaller public libraries especially. So it's really rewarding to be able to give those grants out.
Phil, you mentioned earlier that early on you had an antipathy toward to writing. Did that extend to reading?
No. I loved to read.
Even as a youngster?
Oh, yeah.
And were you a library goer at the time?
Oh, yes.
Which library?
Danville Public Library.
Give the shout out here. You still hit the Danville Public Library?
2 to 3 times a week.
And what sorts of books did you like to read?
When I was a kid, I remember working my way through the entire collection of the Childhood of Famous American Biography series.
The orange books?
That had to be completely made up. I mean, they had whole dialogues with Abraham Lincoln like someone was actually there and tape recording it.
Yeah.
But they just really ignited my imagination. And so I remember those and, of course, the Hardy Boys and the Happy Hollisters and you know, the kind of stuff we grew up on. Yeah.
So when you made the transition to being a writer, most writers I know, there, even if it's another writer or a set of writers whose style is entirely different from theirs or whatever, find inspiration in reading others' works? Was there a writer or a set of writers that you see as kind of inspirations for the kind of work that you do?
I became a real avid fan of the essays of E.B. White that appeared in Harper's and New Yorker's. Someone gave me a gift of his book, The Second Tree from the Corner, and I just loved his facility with language, and so began reading him pretty deeply, and which, of course, then led to other writers that he would talk about and other writers during his time who were writing about the same kinds of things, which has now led me to reading his stepson, Roger Angel, who I think now is 97 and still.
Still just had a book come out, right?
Yeah.
This Old Man.
This Old Man, which is a fantastic book. So I'm enjoying his work now and delving back into all of his old baseball books that he wrote. So now I just kind of read and then see where that book, see where the book I'm reading now takes me.
What was it about E.B. White? You said the facility of the language, but there's a very distinctive voice there, too. That
boy, there were so many things he did so well. Obviously, the clarity of his work and his worldview. You could tell when you read him that he absolutely loved life. And that just shines through his work, that he approached the world almost as if a child, that everything seemed to fascinate him, that nothing was beneath his notice, and that while others were writing about big, significant moments, he was just writing about life on his saltwater farm. But he ended up espousing the same values, insights that others were when they wrote about World War II and the Depression and the Red Scare and McCarthyism and all of that, which we think are past moments in history. But as we can see from today, McCarthyism is alive and well in America. We've just found a new enemy.
So with White, I agree with you, by the way, he's a marvel. In addition, there are a couple of things that strike me when I think of his work. The first is that he makes things that literary feats that are not easy look way too easy. That you just think, oh,
yeah.
You know, that looks like he didn't sweat that at all. But the other part of it that I think speaks to, and I see the points of comparison with your work, is that he was just an absolutely incredible observational reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, he had this tremendous gift for recreating moments, scenes, or settings on the page. Is that the kind of standard that you set for yourself when you approach the act of writing?
Yeah, I don't often achieve it, but I sure do try. You know, his story, Death of a Pig, and Once More to the Lake, deal with the brevity of time and the fragility of life. But he does it so wonderfully. So when I sit down to write, I think, I just remember Tom Mullen always telling me, show, don't tell, and figuring out, okay, is there a story that can convey this? Yeah.
What kind of response do you want your readers to have when they read some of your work? I mean, I know I studied under Walter Ong, who was president of the Modern Language Association. He said, you know, the writer's audience is always a fiction, that you're imagining someone. And, you know, most of us do have somebody in mind when we're thinking about this. What kind of response do you want them to have?
Well, I get a mix of mail and emails, some very complimentary, some very derogatory and critical. And I always enjoy the critical ones more because they tend to engage me. agreement is so boring. I really like to be challenged and even condemned. That doesn't bother me a bit. It kind of enlivens me and makes me look forward to writing the next essay or the next book. I like when I write to feel as if I'm standing on the edge of a precipice looking down into the abyss of hell, and that with one good push I might end up there. I like that feeling.
So we're getting close on time here. Katie, real quickly, if people want to attend the festivities on the 29th, where should they go to get the information?
Yes, they should go to IndianaAuthorsAward.org. There's also a call-out button on the homepage of the Indianapolis Public Library site, too. So either way, you can find out information about all the events that are taking place that day.
And when do things start in the morning?
Technically, we have a special workshop just for educators, and that's happening before the library even opens. So that's pretty exciting. That's new territory for us. But 10 a.m. is when it opens to the public.
10 a.m., and I understand you've got some jerk interviewing the...
I guess his name's John Kroll. I don't know, but...
Well, I would like to thank you both and also like to thank New York Times columnist David Brooks for talking with us. This has been a real literary feast for us. Also like to thank our listeners. We will be back on Tuesday with a live show. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.